Welcome to the New York City Bar Association podcast. The City Bar Digital Technologies Task Force teams up today with the Financial Technology Association for a deep dive into the state of fintech. First on the agenda is a closer look at a forthcoming CFPB rule on open banking that could reshape the fintech landscape.
I think it is the critical aspect of the entire stage of fintech. It really is not an overstatement to say that fintech is built on 1033.
There is incredible ability to expand the inclusion of everyone in our financial system.
Leaders from MoneyLion, Plaid, Remitly, and WebBank talk about their top-of-mind issues.
As fintech leaders, we have to remain at the forefront of emerging technologies.
The group also talked about how AI is used and regulated in financial services, and how banks partner with fintech companies to offer digital tools to American consumers and businesses.
AI and machine learning hold incredible promise to drive innovation and really valuable consumer and small business products.
Opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the City Bar or the Financial Technology Association.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining this New York City Bar State of FinTech podcast. My name is Angelina Bradfield, and I am the head of policy and government relations for the Financial Technology Association, a trade association that represents digitally native financial technology companies, some of which have representatives on today's podcast. I also co-chair the New York City Bar Association's Task Force Subcommittee on Articles and Blogs. We are grateful to the bar for their willingness to host today's discussion. I am joined by an illustrious panel, and we'll go ahead and introduce them now. First, we have Adam von Wagner, who is the Chief Legal Officer and Secretary of New York-based MoneyLion and has been with the company since 2018. MoneyLion is a financial technology company delivering a consumer finance platform with banking, investing, and lending capabilities, as well as an embedded finance marketplace for enterprise businesses. It also has a media arm that produces content on finance and related topics. Next, we have Matt Cameron, who is the head of policy and regulatory affairs for Remitly, which is a trusted provider of digital financial services that transcend borders. Remitly helps customers across the globe send money home in a safe, reliable, and transparent manner. Its digitally native cross-border remittance app eliminates the long wait times, complexities, and fees typical of traditional remittance processes. Meredith Fuchs is the general counsel for Plaid. She leads the legal, risk, and policy team in all efforts relating to Plaid and previously served as senior vice president, chief counsel, and regulatory advisor at Capital One. Meredith joined Capital One from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where she was general counsel and acting deputy director after serving as chief of staff to CFPB Director Richard Cordray. Finally, we have Paris Sanz, who is an executive vice president, general counsel, and head of policy at WebBank, a leader in bank fintech partnerships with over 25 years of experience and 35 partners, including well-known brands and FTA members like PayPal, Intuit, Klarna, and Zip. Paris is a fintech OG with over 16 years as a GC and operations executive at small business and consumer fintech platforms and over 3 years at WebBank. Thanks so much to all of you for joining today. I'm really looking forward to the conversation. So we will go ahead and jump into the discussion with a question for Meredith. We're here to, of course, talk about the state of fintech. And conveniently, Plaid fields a survey every year called the Fintech Effect that examines how consumers are using fintech and what it means for their financial lives and well-being. Can you give us some of the top line takeaways from your 2023 survey and what that could mean for the industry as it moves forward?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Our FinTech Effect survey is showing that we have finally achieved a fundamental shift in how consumers manage their financial lives. Something like 80% of U.S. consumers use at least one FinTech application, and there is no way people are going to go back to paper. So we are excited to see that consumers are finding value. Consumers are saving money. Something like 84% say they're better off using FinTech. And 90% of consumers say that fintech applications help them manage their money in ways that reduce financial stress. So those are exciting enough figures. But in addition to that, There is incredible ability to expand the inclusion of everyone in our financial system. And we've seen that fintech adoption rates are equalizing across all demographic groups and income levels. So that means that there are now products out there to offer features that service particularly women or families or immigrants or gig workers. And that's part of what makes fintech such an amazing area.
Thanks so much, Meredith. And I think it's really encouraging to hear what fintech is doing on financial inclusion. I know it's something that's also important to the New York City Bar as well and the task force. So those are great statistics. You also are the former GC of the CFPB. So I'm sort of curious, like, how do you think about these takeaways in the current legal and regulatory environment? And sort of more simply put, where are we and where do we need to go from a policy level, particularly at the federal level?
Well, in general, it's pretty hard for regulators to keep up with fast-moving innovations. And so for the last couple of years, frankly, regulators probably were a little bit behind in keeping an eye on what's happening in digital financial services. But now that products like the ones we're talking about today have been around for a long time, and with this incredible amount of consumer adoption, regulation is catching up. And frankly, we think that's a good thing because strong consumer protections and rules of the road are going to accelerate the development of services and also increase consumer trust. And ultimately, it's essential that this industry operate with the same level of trust as more traditional industries. So in particular, you asked about the CFPB or you mentioned that there is an open banking rule coming from the CFPB that is going to ensure that no matter where you bank or what fintech app or service you choose, the consumer is the one who has the right to securely control and share their information with financial institutions and with whomever they wish. And that is a dramatic change, which is really exciting. And I wanted to particularly just point out a couple of reasons why that rule is so important. One is that I think it's going to really enable consumers to finally be able to take advantage of pay by bank as an alternative to using credit cards and debit cards. And consumers are very open to that. And there's a lot of consumer benefits in pay by bank. The other thing that has long been looked forward to is the ability to use cash flow to help with underwriting. Traditionally, people's credit scores and their ability to get access to the credit system is dependent on large consumer reporting agencies. Well, now that doesn't necessarily capture everything about their financial picture. So with cash flow underwriting, there's a real opportunity to make sure that people are getting access to the right credit for them.
Thanks so much, Meredith. And I think that explanation about open banking with the future CFPB rule and its potential is so important for consumers as we talk about these fintech products and where the industry is moving. Let me bring Adam into the conversation. You, Adam, you work at a financial technology company that has many different sort of products and services. How are you looking at things like the open banking rule, but also sort of the regulatory environment, particularly at the state level as well? And what are your current top of mind issues?
Yeah, thanks, Angelina. It's great to be here and looking forward to the conversation with a great group of fintech leaders. Let me start by giving a sense of MoneyLion's perspective. Because of our positioning as a financial services marketplace, we end up taking a fairly broad view of the regulatory environment. We do offer a host of first-party products across banking, lending, earned wage access, and investing. We also provide marketplace solutions that connect millions of consumers to third-party financial products as well as to our own. So what that means is that we're looking at regulations that impact not only our own product lines, but also laws and regulations that affect our partners and the overall fintech marketplace. So it's important for MoneyLion to be a participant and advocate for regulatory frameworks that create innovation and consumer choice across fintech and the financial services landscape more broadly. Meredith did a great job of queuing up the dynamics we're seeing playing out at federal level and the interaction with the states. And Angelina, as you've written about, the interaction and the interplay between federal and state regulatory regimes. There's a lot of focus on the states, I would say, and that's been increasing over the last couple of years. In terms of the state regulatory framework for fintech as it exists today, a key word that comes to my mind is legacy. Across the states, MoneyLion and other fintechs are subject to licensure regimes, supervision, and overall regulation built generally for a brick and mortar financial system. That can mean obtaining state level lending licenses, working with a state banking regulator, and that's regardless of whether you have a fintech bank partnership, or addressing a state data privacy law. And I won't steal much of Matt's thunder, but money transmission is one of the heaviest regulated finance activities that remains largely done at the state level. There are some exceptions to this legacy notion. The effort by a state like Wyoming in the crypto space comes to mind. And you do have some opportunities for state-level regulatory sandboxes in places like Arizona and Utah and a couple of other states. But overall, we are seeing at the state level anyway, a legacy move with some efforts to embrace emerging technologies and fintech products. On the current approach, you asked about what's on the mind of us as well as legislators and regulators at the state level. I'm going to bucket that into three different categories. The first category is what I'll call applying old laws to new products. We've seen a number of states pass laws or adopt regulations geared towards fintech by working to wedge some fintech-like provisions into an existing regime. That can be particularly true of lending requirements at the state level, where you do have kind of decades of experience by the regulators with lending laws. And so there are sometimes quick efforts to put provisions in place in state laws that already exist to cover lending to try to regulate new product categories. The next category I'll call fintech laws, and these are efforts to adopt a regulatory framework that takes into account the new and unique features of a fintech product, while of course ensuring appropriate consumer protections. So we and others in the industry, along with Angelina and team at the FTA, have been active around earned wage access bills. You're also seeing this in the crypto space, as well as in areas like BNPL. And I think it's safe to say that as fintechs mature and start hitting scale, you're going to see more activity on this front as state legislators and regulators recognize the need to create regimes that are tailored to emerging product categories as fintech expands. As we sit today, I'm going to call the results here somewhat mixed. The laws tend to be either done in a way that gives clarity to industry and spurs more innovation, or frankly, sometimes seemingly designed to eliminate the particular fintech product from the state. And from what we see, sometimes there's not much in between there. And then finally, the third category, which is the laws and regulations that are applicable beyond just financial services that can have a significant impact on fintechs. Here in particular, I'm talking about states looking to regulate AI, as well as the expanding reach of data privacy laws. In a lot of cases, we're focused on whether or not laws and regulations like that are going to embrace emerging technologies or whether they might stifle innovation and consumer choice before financial technology companies and other innovators are able to create and distribute their products to consumers.
Thanks so much, Adam. I think that's really interesting, particularly the bucketing that you did to kind of share for listeners what we're really seeing in the state. Let me turn to Matt, who as a cross-border payments company is both sort of regulated at the state and federal level. Where do you see these policy conversations moving for your company, especially on key issues like Fed access for payment companies and other elements?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, Angelina. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today with this pretty impressive group of fintech leaders. Meredith, it's great to see you. Our time crossed when we were at the CFPB together, and it was great to see you in action. I'll just note first that I personally found Plaid's Fintech Effects Survey to be especially informative in finding that users are leveraging more digital apps than years in past to manage money. And that includes in the payments context. And this is certainly the case for us. As you mentioned, at Remitly, we're a global digital remittance provider. We started in 2011, and we help people send money all over the world, especially to friends and loved ones in developing nations. Before Remitly entered the market, the state of the system was pretty broken. It was overpriced, it was slow, inconvenient, and it was frankly pretty confusing. There was 9% average in fees in 2011. It took 3 to 5 days to send money internationally. No visibility of where the money was in the process. Long wait times to pick up the funds at locations, which is just not fair for consumers. And so largely because of digital competition, we think, and a stable regulatory environment with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's remittance rule, which came out in 2013, the global average for fees have dropped to 6%, with digital providers serving as the lowest cost and most efficient option for consumers. Remitly is well below that global average. So this is so important since our services really are essential for so many around the world needing fast, transparent, low-cost access to funds for family to support just basic needs like education and emergency relief. With respect to your question, so yes, Remitly is a well-regulated payments company. We're subject to supervision by the CFPB. We comply with the remittance rule, which requires pricing transparency for consumers. And we're also subject to state licensing and money transmission oversight by the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And so with the general regulatory framework in place, we think it's working well, but we have some additional policy ideas, obviously, where we can further enhance financial access and inclusion, as well as the ability for fintechs to better meet consumer needs. One policy idea that I'm especially focused on right now, because of the impact it can have both on consumers and the U.S. economy, is expanding direct payment access to central bank rails to well-regulated remittance providers, but more broadly to non-banks. And so this is not just a dream of mine that I think about way too often in my personal time. There has actually been significant activity in leading jurisdictions around the world to expand direct access to central bank payment infrastructure to non-banks. And that's really resulted in simplified, more transparent and efficient and lower cost transactions for consumers. Countries and regions like the UK, Singapore, India, Brazil, Switzerland, Canada, and the European Union have all authorized or in the process now of authorizing such direct access because they recognize the transformative potential that could have. And in the US, we're frankly behind. The Treasury Department did a great report in 2022 on the future of money and payments, and they rightly highlighted the potential benefits of expanding Federal Reserve payment system participation beyond the traditional banks to promote competition and access, especially for underserved communities. Remittance companies are really a logical category, but I think non-banks more broadly too, given that we are already supervised and examined by the CFPB as well as state regulators. And so we think this topic is really going to gain momentum in 2024 and beyond. And I also think that such payments access should also be a central pillar to the national financial inclusion strategy that the Treasury Department is currently in the process of developing right now.
Thanks so much. That's really helpful. And I think really helpful context as we kind of continue this conversation. I'd say what I'm hearing right now is two different threads. One, fintech is sort of opening inclusion, both here in the US and around the world. And I think that's a really sort of important element that we need to continue to foster from the federal and state regulatory and policy discussion. So with that, let me pull Paris in, who both worked in financial services and several roles in-house at fintechs and then now at a bank that partners with fintechs. What is your perspective on the current state of fintech policy and where do you see it going?
Yeah, thanks, Angelina. Great to be here. As just a quick side note, I would applaud the efforts to support 1033 and open banking, as the other panelists have mentioned. I think there is a lot of good that can be done there. There's already validation. FinReg Lab some years ago released a study of cash flow underwriting and showed what's inclusive. That's it's fair lending risk. So definitely applaud that. That said, though, in a nutshell, I think that the current state of fintech policy in general is pretty rough. As you indicated, I've been in the fintech space for a long time, since '04, was about 16 years on the fintech side and 3+ years now on web. And in general, I would say that with the notable exception of court-raised regulation through enforcement, sorry, Myrons, fintech policy was a lot more supportive of innovation during the previous two administrations. Back then, makers and regulators were a lot less inclined to step in so quickly and aggressively for fear that they might impede or stifle innovation. And these days, it seems that just the opposite is true at both the federal and the state levels. I'll give you two quick examples. In years past, new entrants into small business finance would offer sales-based financing that was structured as a purchase of future receivables instead of a loan. Many players took this approach, including Square, Shopify, Toast, and others. Today, such products are subject to a very burdensome and diverse patchwork of state commercial finance disclosure laws, essentially TILA for small businesses. Moreover, similar attempts to structure new innovative consumer products as non-loans, including the original BNPL and EWA product constructs, were almost immediately met with suspicion and resistance at federal and state levels. The other example I'll give, which is very near and dear to my heart, is the treatment of tech partnerships. Regulatory scrutiny of bank partnerships is more intense than it has ever been before, which would be fine if all partner banks and fintechs were just being held to the same high standards. But what's happening today goes way beyond that, to the point of choke point 2.0 type treatment. Moreover, multiple states are now attacking bank partnerships with predominant economic interest-based true lender statutes that would treat the fintech as the lender for state laws if it purchases bank-originated loans. And I find it very disappointing to see these developments when, if you look at the empirical data, it clearly shows that banks like WebBank are expanding access to capital for underserved, below-prime consumers with responsible credit products, while most of the high APR products criticized by consumer advocates come from state-licensed lenders, tribal lenders, other providers, not state-chartered. These approaches to address perceived predatory products, they're vastly over-inclusive. They adversely affect responsible credit providers like WebBank. They essentially throw the baby out. So in general, I would say 10 years ago or so, lawmakers and regulators essentially presumed that fintechs expanded credit choices and enhanced inclusion and access to capital for underserved small businesses and consumers. Today, the pendulum has swung to the opposite end of the spectrum. And I feel like fintechs and their partners are essentially being forced to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the products and services they provide are valuable, transparent, and fair.
Thanks so much, Paris. That's definitely tough to hear, I'm sure, for many in the industry and really tough to deal with. I mean, where do you think go from here then as these discussions move forward?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer. Let me give you just one other example of what I think is pointed in the wrong direction. I'll pick on Colorado for a second. As folks may know, the Attorney General performed a study on Coloradans' access to capital, access to credit, and concluded that it was poor in the state, especially for low and moderate income consumers. And then shortly after that study was released, a bill was introduced to opt out of DIDMICA. I don't know, some people say DIDMICA, some people say DIDA. It's basically the federal statute that gives state chartered banks the same rate exportation authority as nationally chartered banks. Why did they roll out this bill? Beats me. There was no research or empirical data to indicate that it would benefit Coloradans. And if you looked at the CFPB's consumer complaint database at that time, you would see that among the top 10 high APR lenders most complained about by Coloradans, 5 were tribal lenders, 3 were national banks, and 2 were state licensed lenders. None was a state chartered bank. Yet for some reason, Colorado lawmakers felt it was imperative that they become the third jurisdiction to try to deny state chartered banks rate exportation authority, following the lead of Puerto Rico and Iowa. And if you look at the data, Iowa's access to credit is even worse than Colorado's. So I would argue that Colorado's DIDMICA opt-out is a solution without a problem. In terms of where we should go from here, I would argue that policy and lawmakers should really focus on serving their citizens by paying attention to the empirical research findings about access to credit and the associated consumer outcomes, instead of selling well-intentioned soundbites that actually hurt the people they claim to be fighting for.
That's really helpful, Paris. And I think the explanation is particularly helpful as we know that everyone is so reliant on bank fintech partnerships. Maybe Meredith, if you want to go ahead and give some thoughts maybe on that, and then I'll move to Adam after that.
Sure. I just want to take a second and comment on what Paris said. I think part of the reason that the regulatory efforts have been sort of mixed is because different regulators have different agendas. And so we see the prudential regulators and the consumer protection regulators and the state and the federal ones not necessarily pursuing the same policy. And one of the things that's very interesting that I think Paris highlighted that is a big concern for me as well is that sometimes they'll focus on the specific problem and not look at the broader impact of what they're doing. And in some cases, they've even created sort of unlevel playing fields because they're trying to solve one problem and not understand by solving that problem, they're actually creating an advantage to one part of the industry or another. I don't know exactly what the answer is to this problem. we have tried ourselves as a company and in advocating for regulatory change to try to make things as neutral as possible on the competition side so that we can focus on actually providing safe, secure, trustworthy services for consumers. That's always been our focus. And I suspect for many of the companies here, that's the same. Turning a little bit more to like the partnership question that you asked about, for folks who don't know, Plaid is sort of an infrastructure provider. We're the company that helps connect your fintech apps with your bank account. And so for us, the way we interact with banks, for instance, is absolutely critical. And we have partnerships now with nearly all of the top 10 banks, as well as thousands of other financial institutions to ensure that data can flow from consumers' accounts to other places where they want to get service. And most consumers actually, according to our study, have said that they would consider switching banks if their primary bank could not connect to other financial apps. I think this is incredibly exciting because what it shows is consumers have power in this as opposed to large financial institutions or large businesses that kind of lock them in. So that's really exciting. The other big trend that we're seeing that is coming out of these partnerships is that not only are the largest institutions providing data now that can be shared and become portable, but we're also seeing that they are leveraging the open banking system themselves to improve their own products. And that's one of the things that's really exciting about what fintech has done is it has pushed traditional businesses themselves to innovate. And so the apps that people might have today from their banks are nothing like the apps they had 10 years ago because the banks are responding to what they see the innovators doing. That's really exciting. And we're finding that particularly some of the smaller banks and the credit unions and the community banks are finding that by adding in these kinds of new technologies, they're able to hold on to consumers that they would not have been able to hold on to in the past. And so, I mean, I think I would just kind of bring back like the trend today is really focused on finding ways that we can enhance the trust. Because in the early days of fintech, the traditional financial institutions and banks were very skeptical. And part of that was because of their regulators. To Paris's point, their regulators were focused on safety and soundness, number one. We want to make sure that they understand that this system is not going to undermine the safety and soundness of the banking system. But what it is going to do is it's going to let consumers have some power in that system.
That's really helpful perspectives, Meredith. I think it kind of provides that more holistic and broad view, given how many regulators, as we've talked about before, really participate in this conversation. Moving to Adam, who does have the privilege of dealing with both state and federal regulators, how have you seen these dynamics play out for your business, particularly the downward pressure on bank fintech partnerships, but also the importance of these partnerships and where the innovation is going, as we've heard throughout this podcast?
Yeah, thanks. These bank partnerships are critical for us and our business. I mean, on a basic level, we couldn't offer our banking product without a strong banking partner like we have that serves as the issuer for that product. So it's simply fundamental to our business and the product offerings of many of our partners. Look, some of these recent regulatory actions are putting a spotlight on some risks at banks with fintech partnerships. And in general, we'd all agree where necessary, that's a step that a regulator should take. But at times, I think the headlines have been a bit overblown and missing a broader story. And I think they run contrary to what we're seeing in the broader maturation of these relationships as fintech grows. And I'll go back to that Plaid Fintech Effect Survey. Meredith got into this. It really is a key takeaway that trust in fintech is rising. Already those trust numbers are closing in on traditional banks, and that's an important thing. And I also think it shouldn't be a surprise, particularly as we've witnessed the broader expanse of fintech and adoption by digital consumers and the growth of these businesses over the years. MoneyLion is a public company, as are many other fintechs. We and others are in a position where it's absolutely critical from a business operational level and a brand and consumer-facing level to have risk programs that are as strong as a traditional financial institution. That's how fintech can continue to build trust and build businesses that can operate at scale. In a sense, bank and fintech partnerships provide the best of both worlds. You have the certainty and comfort with a traditional financial institution standing behind a product, while also having the new tech-enabled platform that allows that to be an incredible user experience and drive great outcomes. I love that Meredith mentioned the idea of competition and the criticality of having regulatory regimes that embrace that. In our view, the best financial services system for consumers is one that provides the most access to consumers and gives them the ability to access the most products. And that means a robust fintech industry coupled with a strong traditional banking sector across the country. The key going forward for that is going to be creating the ability to distribute and connect products from as many providers, fintech and traditional services, across the digital ecosystem.
Thanks so much, Adam. And I think we're continuing to hear that thread of what open banking is doing today and what a final 1033, I think, rule has the potential to do for the future. Matt, let me bring you in here. Remitly sends money all over the world. And so bank fintech partnerships are likely particularly important to you all as we think about some of these issues. What are your top of mind sort of policy issues?
Yeah, well, I agree with what's been said so far. I would just say that we highly value our bank partnerships. The partnerships really add depth to our robust pay-in and disbursement networks that we have, which really improves the optionality for customers. We also invest heavily in compliance in order to ensure that we and our bank partners are satisfying regulatory expectations. I'll mostly defer to the group on the broader atmosphere of bank fintech partnerships here, but I do think there's a relevant issue around de-risking that's been talked about a lot in financial services, and especially in this context. And there was a really enlightening New York Times article that highlighted the consumer impact from de-risking and really encouraged the readers to take a look at it. For those who aren't familiar with the issue, de-risking really occurs when a financial institution shuts off services to consumers or de-risks them instead of going through the process to confirm that the activity on their account was actually legitimate activity. There's been reports where consumers with little to no explanation have had their checking account access blocked and not been able to access their funds for several weeks. And that's just not acceptable in today's day and age, and especially for law-abiding consumers. Earlier last year, Remitly's CEO, Matt Oppenheimer, penned an op-ed in American Banker following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. And in the piece, he went on and highlighted the importance of maintaining a broad and diverse banking sector that really ensures that there are banks able to and seeking to partner with fintechs, including in the remittance space, to serve customers. De-risking really is a threat to these bank fintech partnerships, especially if regulators convey that cross-border payment services should be subject to even greater any money laundering or know your customer requirements. And instead, I think we really need to be looking for ways to satisfy important law enforcement objectives without doing harm by forcing banks to de-risk.
Thanks so much. I feel like we could do an entire podcast specifically on de-risking as itself. I think it's a really important topic. And I think just broadly, if you're thinking about even going back a decade ago, talking about foreign correspondent de-risking, it's really in many times the downward pressure from those types of partnerships, particularly from a regulatory standpoint, that prompted kind of the place that we are today. As we think about this tension in the market, we've talked a lot about open banking. It is sort of a foundational piece of the fintech industry, and it underpins the connectivity and many of these relationships. What products, from your perspective, are you using that facilitate open banking? And where do you think the potential impact of a 1033 rule goes, even with some of these bank fintech partnership dynamics? Maybe Adam, I'll start with you first.
Well, we use Plaid, the infrastructure provider. I'm really glad we're talking about 1033. In many ways, I think it is the critical aspect of the entire stage of fintech. It really is not an overstatement to say that fintech is built on 1033. The ability for consumers to choose and permission their data for uses outside of their primary traditional banking relationship has created the explosion of new innovation and broader access to services that we see today. This is why it's essential that regulators get the 1033 rule right. Angelina, is the key issue that FTA and fintech observers are tracking is this idea of a secondary use case around that permission data. Right now, the initial rule that was drafted would limit the use cases
consumer permission data to a single product, really a single primary use case. Ultimately, that doesn't seem like the right answer, either for businesses or consumers. Let's go back to that Plaid survey again. Consumers are craving personalization in financial services. The type of personalization that consumers are asking for that can lead them to more access and better choices really can only be delivered by allowing for a more dynamic use of consumer permission data to deliver those customers a more personalized and broader array of services. That type of personalization and consumer engagement is exactly what we're trying to build through a marketplace. And it's imperative that this rulemaking recognizes massive consumer benefits to that type of personalization and a deeper ongoing interaction with a customer.
Thanks so much, Adam and Meredith. Anything you would have to add to that?
Yeah, I would love to jump in. I really appreciate what Adam was saying. And I wanted to raise another kind of example of how things are changing in part because data can now be shared. One of the sort of unexpected benefits of the data sharing that's going on is that we can improve our anti-fraud efforts. And so this ties into what you were talking about a moment ago. If you think about the past where information, consumer data was siloed at individual banks, they weren't sharing amongst themselves unless they had to. So each on their own was trying to solve the problem of fraud and illegality. And then the law requires certain things are reported to the government. And so maybe there was like in that compilation of data, things could be found. One of the amazing things for a company like ours, because we're sort of a hub for some of this data sharing, is that we are beginning to see that there's an opportunity to develop advanced fraud detection algorithms. And that ability to share data between financial institutions may make it easier for us to prevent criminality and make it more difficult for cyber criminals to attack targets and cover their tracks. So going back to a little bit what Adam was saying, one of the concerns we have about regulation, and particularly 1033, because it is so focused on the specific service or product that the consumer requested, is that it may be ignoring the fact that there's actually some consumer benefits to figuring out how to prevent fraud and criminality. And those are also benefits for the entire system. Sure, they benefit the banks, they benefit the fintech applications, but they absolutely benefit consumers because consumers' products and services are going to be cheaper if there's less fraud and criminality. And of course, the consumers are not going to have to deal with the problems of people interfering with their accounts. So one of the things we would really hope in the 1033 rule that the CFPB considers is that collecting and using data for anti-fraud and anti-criminality efforts is a positive thing for the system and is not something that should be prohibited.
That's super helpful. And I think it transitioned us nicely to another big topic from a digital technology perspective, which is the use of AI, particularly financial services. Obviously, AI has been used for many years for fraud detection and prevention mechanisms. To your point, secondary data is one of the tools used to really train those models and algorithms, because that's the information that can make the tools more accurate in detecting potential fraud and allow to get in front of that transaction. I think the other piece, one of the other areas where AI is used a lot, of course, is in financial crimes generally, and also in the monitoring, detection, and reporting required from an AML perspective as well. Matt, let me bring you in here. You know, AI is a hot topic these days. How is your company thinking about it? And what are regulators at the federal and state level, what do you think they should know about how you are using it responsibly?
Yeah, it's a great question. I really believe that as fintech leaders, like, we have to remain at the forefront of emerging technologies. That's what we do. But at Remitly, we're constantly keeping a pulse on new technologies, including artificial intelligence, machine learning, always through the lens really of trying to solve problems and delivering value for our customers. So we've made significant investments in this space to ensure that really legitimate transactions can go through the least amount, but appropriate level of friction, and that we're able to block fraudulent transactions more effectively and in real time using this technology. And so we leverage machine learning and responsible AI with human oversight to accurately make risk decisions. We are also highly focused on improving the customer experience by increasing the number of digital service options. So as an example here, we offer support in 15 languages to our customers. And after thorough testing, we're able to use AI to efficiently serve even more customers by translating and responding to those contacts in real time. And these efforts have been key drivers, really, of more than 95% of customer transactions that we have proceeding without a customer needing to contact our support agents. I think as generative AI becomes more sophisticated, there could be a higher risk to financial services providers who don't leverage AI for fraud detection. So our customers are really our main priority, and we take our responsibility to protect their data very seriously. Cross-border payment companies can be targets for consumer fraudsters, and our machine learning efforts can help us manage fraud rates, but also keep prices low to deliver the best value for our customers.
Thanks so much. Maybe I'll turn to Paris next. I mean, from a bank perspective, what is AI meaning for you?
We believe that AI and machine learning hold incredible promise to drive innovation and really valuable consumer and small business products. I'm a big believer in this. I mean, I had ChatGPT 4.0 draft all my comments for this podcast. Just kidding. But in all seriousness, at the bank, our view is that transparency is paramount. I mean, we totally understand as we work with prospective partners in the industry, many have developed systems that they regard as proprietary. The issue for us is that as a bank, we need to understand the model. As part of model validation, we want to know the variables. We want to know the weighting. We need to know for our own sake and our control of our programs and for the sake of our regulators. Because of that, we actually have declined to partner with some folks in the industry because they weren't willing to be open kimono with us about their AI-driven models. So I would just put out there for fintechs looking to partner with banks to understand you're going to need to open up the black box and ensure that it's transparent, explainable to the bank and to the regulators in order to be able to leverage that kind of.
Thanks so much, Paris. And just to circle back on something you said on model validation for our listeners, if anybody wants some great bedtime reading, I think it's probably the banking agency's 11-7 guidance on model validation and managing model risk that I think is probably one of the preeminent pieces out there on how we even think about managing AI today. Obviously, we'll see where this goes in the future. Let me turn to Adam. What's MoneyLion's perspective on the use of AI?
Thanks, Angelina. I'll follow up on Paris and agree on the idea of disclosure in the use of these models. Absolutely critical, but also want to be mindful of regulations here not being overreactive or only capturing a moment in time where we are with AI. AI is a buzzword across regulatory conversations and is becoming a bit of a bogeyman. The use of AI in financial services should and will be regulated, but AI's potential use cases for creating better consumer outcomes is almost infinite. We shouldn't be unnecessarily clamping down on an emerging tool like this without making sure we're allowing flexibility for its benefits. This is where the interaction of some of the emerging AI-related and other state laws and other regulations can be sort of fascinating and also somewhat perplexing. For instance, like to go back to 1033, the spirit of 1033 and what was introduced through Dodd-Frank is the idea of opening up financial services to drive massive amounts of innovation built on consumers being able to decide what companies do with their data. And to parallel what Meredith said, AI can be an extremely useful tool to counteract fraud and help protect the entire system. But if we're spending too much time on sort of near-term scare tactics around AI and other tech-forward innovation, it might have the opposite effect of potentially in the near term inadvertently making it illegal or prohibitive to innovate and drive consumer outcomes the way 1033 and Dodd-Frank intended.
That's really helpful. And I think we've seen so many threads through this conversation, whether it's the way fintechs provided financial inclusion, the potential for the open banking rule, the downward pressure both at the federal and state level that's being put on bank fintech partnerships. And the potential because of that for de-risking, whether at partnership level or as we think about inclusion broadly. As we kind of try to round out this conversation to our listeners, thanks for staying with us this long. Let's kind of go maybe do one more deep dive on a different sort of elements of this, starting first with the increased activity we've heard at the state government level. Do you see the regulatory and enforcement balance shifting? And as an organization, how are you approaching the dual regulatory system as you move forward? So maybe Paris, I'll go ahead and start with you.
Yeah, thanks, Angelina. Yeah, I mean, without doubt, the states have gotten incredibly active. I think many state governments perceive the Trump administration as being somewhat soft on consumer protection, and so they start ramping up their efforts to fill a perceived gap there. But I worry that state activism misses the bigger picture. For example, if every state has its own commercial finance disclosure law, is that going to help or hurt small businesses' access to capital? I would say it's going to hurt. From direct experience, I can tell you in our SMB programs that the diversity of state disclosure requirements creates very significant new operational burdens and expenses that in the final analysis will be passed on to small business borrowers, increasing their cost of capital in an already high rate inflation macro environment. For that reason, we would argue that a uniform national standard would be much better and much more workable for small businesses. And I've already said a lot about state laws targeting partnerships are misguided and end up hurting underserved consumers. So I won't repeat all those comments and bore the listeners with more of that.
Oh, I don't think they were bored, Paris. I think they appreciated your candor. Matt, I'll go ahead and turn to you for Remitly's perspective.
Yeah, I think outside of the regulatory context, but pretty relevant here, we're seeing some state legislators starting to put forward legislation that could tax remittances, which is pretty concerning. There's a couple of bills right now, Arizona, Utah, Kansas, and West Virginia that are considering this. There's also been federal legislation that was introduced. And I think policymakers advocating for taxing remittances to pay for border security and services for immigrants, I think that it's generally concerning policy. And if laws like that were to pass, not only would it be a highly regressive tax, but it also seek to drive those payments underground and out of the traditional banking system, which really makes it harder to catch those bad actors. So I think that's the trend that I'll highlight here, and I'll keep it short for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. It sounds like we have a lot more to talk about in our de-risking podcast for the future. I think kind of ingrained in both of those pieces of feedback is the fact that we are in an election year. So sort of kind of even zooming out a little bit there, it has the potential to be very significant from a presidential to congressional to even a state legislative race. What do you all hope to see and support of fintech after the 2024 election, regardless of kind of the outcome? And where are you hoping some of these policy discussions to go? Maybe Meredith, I'll start with you first.
Well, I think the issue of open banking, which is the 1033 rule that we've been talking about, is not a partisan one. So one of the things I think will happen, no matter what the outcome is, that we will see the advance of digital financial future. And that's, I think, is really exciting. I think you may see some more shifts on some of the issues that Paris was talking about. And part of that is because the open banking thing is sort of about consumer empowerment. When you get into some of the actual products, there's definitely lots more variation in terms of perspectives of what is good or bad for consumers.
That's really helpful. Thank you so much, Meredith. Maybe Matt, kind of bringing in the remittance side of things, how are you thinking about some of these developments?
Yeah, well, I think fortunately supporting digital innovation in the context of remittances is just good national policy, regardless of who's in control. But we've found that elected officials from both parties have constituents in every one of their congressional districts and states that send remittances. And they're doing it to support their loved ones and family abroad. And I think it's really important that sending a remittance isn't a partisan or political issue.
Couldn't agree more. Adam, thoughts from a Moneyline perspective?
Yeah, I'll sum it up in one word, and that's curiosity. For regulators and legislators to be curious about the innovation that's happening, and most importantly, how it's driving better consumer outcomes. FinTech as an industry wants to be regulated. It's a false assumption if anyone says it, that the industry wants any Wild West type regime without regulatory oversight. And that's why you saw companies like Plaid and Meredith's team being such constructive advocates around 1033. And ultimately, that curiosity is what it takes to get to the right answers. Legislators and regulators who are curious and open-minded about learning more about new ways of attacking hard problems and driving access and financial services to consumers.
That's helpful. Thank you so much. It looks like it's about time, I guess, for us to do a rapid fire question for everyone to close out the discussion. So hoping to kind of close on a high note, as we look ahead to the innovation we can expect in the coming years, in 30 seconds or less, what will the state of fintech be in the next 5 years? And what is one thing Washington can do to help that become a reality? Maybe Matt, I'll start with you first.
I'm hopeful for a more modernized national payment system that supports innovation and advancement across the industry. I'll use my time here to just say that I want to thank Angelina and as well as the whole team at the Financial Technology Association for the amazing work that you do to advocate for fintechs. And if you are a fintech and you are listening to this and you're not a part of FTA, you should really consider joining.
Well, thank you so much, Matt. We were not expecting the plug, but we appreciate it. Thanks. Paris, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you and just say it's obviously a pleasure working with you all. So we are grateful to have you as members. Paris?
Yeah, the plug is very well deserved. Thank you very much, Angelina, to you and to FTA. You all do a great job. And so I echo Matt's comments. So in terms of my prediction for the future, I will say there's going to be banking everywhere as an embedded experience, and branches are going to go the way of the dodo bird. In terms of what Washington can do to help, I'll bite on Ted Lasso, or maybe I'm biting on Adam's previous comments. I would say be curious, not judgmental.
We believe. For those who don't watch Ted Lasso, I'm sorry, probably missed the joke. No, but I think that's really helpful. And I mean, again, another podcast we could do about what the future of branches look like and from how we address banking deserts. So let me maybe turn to Adam next then to kind of share your thoughts about where we're going.
Sure. And I have to pile on the FTA love. So Angelina and team, appreciate all the work you do. Great partners and a lot of this advocacy in a really dynamic space. I think Paris said it right. It's going to be about marketplace style access and driving distribution to consumers where they are in digital spaces. That's honestly been the success story for a lot of industries as they've felt their way through what it means to deliver services to consumers online. And financial services ultimately is not going to be any different. DC policymakers, what can they do? They can help by being flexible and open to new paradigms for distributing products to consumers and really focusing on the consumer outcomes that come from that.
Thanks so much, Adam. And Meredith, last word.
I think I'm going to say the same thing in different words, which is I see the future as being a place, a time when every person has the ability to manage their finances from their chosen device, and they're not limited by where they're located, what their socioeconomic background is, or their role in our society. And that ability is safe and ubiquitous. And in terms of what regulators can do and what Washington can do, I mean, look, it's what we're trying to accomplish through FTA, so I'll join in that love. We want to have regulators help us build a system that reaffirms and fosters trust so that we can continue to grow and consumers can get these services, but that doesn't stymie innovation. That's the future, and that's the work that we have ahead of us.
Thanks so much. I think that's the perfect place to end. I want to thank our illustrious panelists for such a thoughtful and substantive discussion. We really appreciate it. I also want to thank the New York City Bar Association's Digital Technologies Task Force as well for their willingness to host us. And please don't hesitate to reach out if you want to discuss any of these items further. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New York City Bar Association podcast. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the City Bar. If you enjoy this podcast, please like and subscribe wherever you listen. Special thanks for today's episode goes to the Financial Technology Association, representing industry leaders shaping the future of finance. Find more City Bar podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeart, or at our website at www.nycbar.org/podcasts. Be sure to check out This Lawyer's Life, a professional development podcast where we talk with lawyers about seizing opportunities, learning lessons the hard way, and about what makes them tick. And don't miss Building Belonging, a podcast that embraces authentic conversations about DEIB solutions by amplifying the most marginalized voices in the legal industry and exploring spaces others dare not. This podcast was produced and edited by Eli Cohen.